everyone, and welcome to our August program of the Political Mandate of the Arts, presented by the Student Council of the Venda Museum and the Thomas Mann House in partnership with DubLab Radio. Thank you for joining us on Zoom or on air. My name is Megana, and I'm so excited to be introducing our guest for this webinar, Amanda Beach. Over the past 7 months of our program, we have hosted a series of conversations with visual artists, musicians, choreographers, writers, cultural critics, and curators, exploring how art and culture can make a difference in times of social and political crisis. Amanda is an artist, writer, and the Dean of Critical Studies at California Institute of the Arts. She works across a wide range of mediums, including but not limited to critical writing, video installation, drawing, print, and sculpture. Beach's work examines narratives of power from philosophical theory, literature, and real political events. Her artwork exerts force and aims to critique neoliberal culture and politics rather than simply reproducing the status quo. Amanda's work has been exhibited in many international venues and biennales. Her work, Covenant Transport Move or Die, which is the one that you saw a little bit of just now, was a solo exhibit at Baltic Contemporary in the UK in 2018. Map of the Bomb is a video work that was exhibited at the Havana Biennale in 2022. Other examples of her work are Asymmetrical Equations, her 2021 series of 11 drawings that were digitally produced, a 2022 book project for Manual for a Future Desert, and Messages from the Inside, an essay on Jean-Francis Lyotard's The Immaterials for the exhibition Beyond Matter at the Center for Art and Media in Karlsruhe, Germany. Her new book, The Intolerable Image, will be published later this year. Her pieces, writings, and exhibitions provoke questions, conversation, and critique, much of which we'll be pursuing in today's conversation. Amanda, thank you so much for joining us today. Today's program will be a 45-minute discussion followed by 15-minute Q&A with the viewers. People can type their questions at any time during the program under the Q&A box at the bottom of your screen. The discussion will be moderated by Lexi, and the Q&A will be led by Anya. Lastly, we would like to thank Susan Horowitz and Rick Feldman for their continued support of the program series at the Venda. Now I'll pass it to Lexi to get the conversation started.
Hi, everyone, and thank you again, Megana, for introducing Ms. Amanda Beach. We're so excited to have you here. I'm so excited to talk about many of the things. As I was doing research on all of your work, I was fascinated as an art lover, history lover, and everything in between. Just excited to talk about a lot today with you and with the rest of the council. So to begin this conversation, I actually wanted to pass it to Gianna to ask her first question.
Thank you, Lexi. So your art takes various forms and you explore your ideas through many different media, colors, and perceptions, all having a sort of connection to each other. What inspires you to connect a specific medium to a particular message when creating your art? And do you have a favorite medium when you are creating your art?
Well, first of all, thanks so much for inviting me. It's really great to be here. And I've had a really interesting time already thinking about what your reactions to my work could be, given that I know you're all from very different disciplines and parts of the US with many different experiences as well. And this question that you're asking about is really difficult to answer. And I think most people, most artists would struggle to answer that really coherently, but I'll try and explain it by saying that a lot of this decision-making comes through ongoing studio practice. And as you've just said, that I do work in different disciplines. I not only work in painting and sculpture and installation and video and drawing, or print, but also I do write critical philosophy. I guess I see that the questions that I'm trying to ask and respond to, or even just propose through art making, require all different ways of speaking, ways of articulating. And I think that I'm definitely not one of these artists who say I can only do this through the painted medium, for example, or I can only do this through making a particular kind of sculpture. So I think that just as what constitutes our lived social reality is made up of our descriptions of it, right? The world we live in is made up of our descriptions of that world. So we live in a world that's full of narrative, full of stories, full of explanations, full of analytics, full of imaginative speculations, and also full of facts. And I think, well, all of these descriptions of reality that make up our lived space have very different attitudes, approaches, methods, and forms. And so for me, as an artist, it's really important to think about, well, how can my artwork work within these different forms? And what am I doing when I'm saying, well, can I force a painting which is, you know, located within one frame on a flatbed? Can it say something that a time-based medium could say, or a three-dimensional medium could offer to an audience? I think all mediums have the capacity to explore complex dimensions in thought and action. And I guess when it comes down to my own personal practice, sometimes I'll find that this idea has to be tried out in a painting, but maybe it ends up being a set of paintings. And then maybe that set of paintings means that I have to even widen the frame even more and make a video and engage in more three-dimensional forms of space and time. And then once I've made that video, it has to become an installation, like a sculpture, which in itself, every image in a video for me becomes like a painting. So if I froze like one part of a video and had a JPEG still, it would be constituted for me like I would constitute a painting. So for me, all of these mediums are kind of wrapped up together and imbricated within each other. And so they bleed in and out of each other, but also each one includes the other. So for me, it's always been really important that I don't make such hard and fast distinctions about what one can do and what one can't. But at the end of the day, also, I might find myself in the studio having to say, I really want to try this out in a series of like painted images, but actually it's not working. And I do need more. I do need another way of saying this. And it might have to be that, okay, well, I need to kind of say this in a more explicatory way or more analytical way that only a philosophical essay could do, or something like that. But in total, I think that what all artists have is a practice, and that's what we call it, a practice where we're constantly practicing and we don't reach a final conclusion. And that kind of amalgamates into an assemblage of ideas and expressions that hopefully together, when looked at as a practice, can offer more than, I guess, hopefully the sum of its parts. So I hope that helps answer a little bit of that question.
Thank you. Well, yeah, I think something that makes your work so interesting, as you said, is your multidisciplinary approach to art and to all of the different mediums that you have in your work, and the experimentation that you were talking about that comes with it and leads to a philosophical examination is also something that's very interesting. And Anya actually has a great question about kind of mediums, art, and the philosophical interpretation and strength of your work.
Yeah, it's interesting. The answer that you provided to the last question is actually kind of answers the question that I had. But I was really struck by that distinction that you made at the end of your answer about art as practice. And so in the interest of not repeating my question, not repeating the repetitive parts of it, I'm wondering if you can elaborate more on that relationship between like the idea and the medium in the process. So if you come in with an idea with kind of a philosophical grounding, or if you come in with an art form, like what is the relationship between those two things as you're working through, okay, what can this medium do for this idea and what can this idea do for this medium and how maybe do they interact with each other?
Yeah, I think that's, again, a question that many, if not all artists, like whatever medium you're working in, kind of face. And that's the excitement about practice, is that it's not... it doesn't kind of reach its any final conclusion. It's always like commas rather than full stops and or hiatuses and then jumping back in. And I think that what I experience when practice works best is that the artwork you're dealing with forces you down in different directions, because you can draw or make or produce a set of things that you think might be grounded in some way or have this capacity to kind of act as some kind of foundation for a set of thoughts. But of course they kind of have this resistant quality. They force you to think in different ways. So imagine anyone, even, I mean, I'm sure you guys are all writing essays of different forms, and you start writing an essay and then you read something and it takes you in a completely different direction. And then you follow that direction and you have to say, well, what was it that I was thinking of originally? And does that matter anymore? Where am I now? And this doesn't mean that you're flaky or distracted or kind of weak-minded or something, but it means that you're following a lead and you're kind of interrogating a path that is not necessarily the one you imagined would be the case, but then becomes absolutely important, or else why would you be following it? So I think this pathway through practice is really important, and it's something that seems to be beyond our intentionality on the one hand, but at the same time, it's part of our decision making in the other, because we decide to follow that path ultimately and to see where it leads and to speculate and imagine what comes from this future that is unknown to us in practice. And I think that's wrapped up with, you know, the kind of question of how, you know, artworks can bring about philosophical questioning or begin from philosophical questioning or political questioning, and where we might have a hunch, a wager, a bet, a kind of conviction that, hey, I think this is something that needs to be urgently addressed, and we might not know everything about that thing. And so part of the practice is not just positing what one thinks about that thing, but is an act of invention and discovery as one is going through the process itself of learning, as well as just assuming that a practice is a place where one has a coherent knowledge base and then kind of prosecutes that in the world as some kind of truth, and then finds out that there's kind of contingencies along the way. I think that we live in a different space than that, where we're always working through ideas, whether we're in artistic practice or not. And that's part of a healthy skepticism, but also part of a kind of commitment, a space of commitment to, you know, and responsibility to one's own beliefs about the world, hoping that those beliefs about the world can be more than just myths or superstitions. We could think about them through analysis and through rigorous thought, both independently and with a community of thinkers and practitioners as well.
Yeah, I appreciate that kind of very consistent emphasis on like the dynamism of the process, but also of the thought that happens outside of the process and kind of interacts with it. So I think that's a really dynamic, I guess, answer. Thank you.
I think also just to add on what Anya just said about interaction and kind of what we were talking about before with invention and discovery and art as a foundation, it kind of led me to think a little bit about your Determinism Noir series. That stuck out a lot to me just because I love film and comics. And when I found your work, I found it interesting that you engaged with this genre of film and a comic genre that often explores themes of fate and existential philosophy. And I was kind of wondering how you drew upon those stylistic elements of film noir and also, I don't know, just that a different style of art to enhance the philosophical discourse on determinism and everything else that you were trying to, you know, figure out and talk about.
Yeah, I really enjoyed doing the comic as well. It was great fun. And I think that, you know, what's interesting about this question of determinism and then this question of noir is that they seem to be contradictory or opposed, because, you know, I'm really interested in the thought of a philosopher who came out of Pittsburgh quite a while ago called Adolf Grunbaum. And he writes about free will and determinism in liberal and neoliberal politics. And he says that he defends determinism all the way. And he explains that determinism is this space where we can say that our actions are caused, or things that we do in the world were caused by other things. And he says that's not the same as saying that we are fated to certain outcomes in the world. Just because we can say that something caused our actions doesn't mean we have guarantees about how the future will be at all. So what's interesting about determinism is that it leaves open the questions of agency. And agency is not something, as we often think about in liberalism, that is my voluntaristic free will is manifest in the world and I can decide what I do next. And that's just me deciding without any contingent material conditions affecting me at all, as if I just have the power alone to make these decisions. And he's critiquing that kind of faith in individualism that a lot of Western politics is really, and capitalism is really supportive of and reliant upon. And he says, well, no, because we're part of a material reality where often our actions are symptoms of maybe our oppression by other forms. And he talks about incarceration a lot in that sense. And he also, therefore, is saying ultimately that whilst we can say that everything is a product of causes in the world, again, it doesn't mean that we are fated to become the prisoner, or we're fated to become a certain human, or that we don't have any agency, we do not decide. So this idea of noir, I think, in determinism speaks to that there's a capacity for the unknown that appears in determinism that's not hypostatized as some ineffable quality, or it's not magical. It's just that we can say that whilst we can have reasons for causes, and causes are also can be reasons in themselves, reasons and causes are not the same, that there's a kind of rift between them that creates this kind of tension or this site of alienation. And then the world of noir is very interesting to me because historically I just love the history of noir and the way that film noir, especially being in Los Angeles, is really exciting because, you know, I think of film noir as an LA phenomenon, although I know it's everywhere too, everywhere else. But I particularly love LA depictions of noir. And here we see this idea of the alienated subject, often the cop, who, although he's part of the sight of law. He's also alienated from even the law. He's usually a private detective, not a regular cop. It's a private operation. And this idea of always being in the dark, quite literally in these films, where the filmmakers would create these very dark shadows that would literally, or well, metaphorically cut the subject in two. So you'd have a face that's cut by a line of darkness and light, and it would fragment the idea of a whole subject. So noir is interesting because it kind of does what determinism does. It tells us that the free will that we imagine we have does not exist, that we're alienated. So determinism and noir have got something very much in common. They show us a subject who's alienated, who is still making decisions and determining a future, but they're part of a complex set of operations where they're just a fragment in the world. So the comic kind of tries to address directly the art world from this perspective, from this determinism noir perspective. And the comic is quite funny to me because it makes jokes about the art world. People who believe in free will and people who believe in voluntaristic agency, but also people who are the opposite to that and believe that we're all fated to give up in the face of capital and just confess our guilt in the sight of our oppression. And so I'm kind of against both of those views, because whilst I think that capitalism is absolutely oppressive and we need to talk about that, I also believe that we are capable of determining other futures. So I'm kind of more optimistic than a kind of standard form of tragic nihilism. So the comic is kind of deliberately a kind of joke in a way about the failings of the art world. And all of the pictures in the comic are actually true stories that happened. And they're embellished a little bit with funny pictures, but the stuff that is captioned in a lot of the bubbles is actually what people have said at conferences, mostly in panel discussions about art, that curators have said to me. And I think it's really important that we kind of have a healthy skepticism about some of the forces at play that kind of are very, have a strong monopoly in the art world itself, a world that I'm in to some degree, but also a world that I have a lot of problems with. And I know many artists find themselves in that position as well. I hope that helps kind of explain that comic.
No, it definitely does. And I think that even though, as you said, they do seem to contradict, the perspective and different narrative kind of gives it the chance to enhance the viewer and your experience as an artist, just to take it all in and learn new things and just provide commentary and discourse on both things of philosophy, determinism, film noir, and more, whatever anybody can think of to expand on it. And then you talked about agency, which I thought was super interesting, because Gianna has a great question about accountability within the arts and within school, and I would love to pass it to her to ask.
Yes, thank you, Lexi. When I was watching one of your classes, you briefly mentioned your accountability as an artist, like your own. And I was wondering what inspired you to take on a role of accountability within the arts, and how does accountability and activism look different for various artists?
Well, this is a huge question, and I'm sure you know that already, because as you say, it, as you imply, it looks different for many artists. I think one of the things, I mean, I'd be interested to also ask you what, in your experience, you've understood as, say, an activist artwork. I mean, I don't want to put you on the spot and you don't have to answer, but what do you have a kind of thought in your own mind about what an activist artwork might appear like for you?
Of course, I'd love to share. I think that activism and artwork comes in all form. You don't necessarily have to say exactly what you're trying to say. Like, it doesn't have to say, this is what I want to change. It could be a painting with the hidden message, or it could very well just be a video where you're saying, this is what I want to change, in the form of art. And I think that there's different artists who have very different media. And I just think that people and different artists can choose to have a different level of accountability, maybe. And I was hoping that you could dive into that part. Like, what do you think your level is? And do you think that all artists have that same level? Or do you think that the level in what they're trying to, the message that you're trying to give people, does that change their level of accountability?
Well, I think I think it's a really interesting diagnosis or description you've just put forward, which is basically saying that because artwork comes in all shapes and sizes and all modes of approach, we cannot say definitively what a political artwork is when we think of politics in the sense that you're talking about, as in something that can, I think you're using the word activism because it seems to imply a very direct mode of operation or agency in the world of lived reality. And of course, because artworks are mediations, they're representations, the question then is, well, something that's already like distanced from what we consider to be the doings in the world that we do, how do representations kind of manifest in our reality and allow us to rethink what that reality is, allow us to make decisions and determine other futures. And we could say that, you know, in the world of art, there's no comprehensive way of saying that one artwork will do that while another one will not. So, for example, you could say that an artwork that was made many years ago under a completely different set of circumstances than we might live in today could be revised and rehabilitated and reinterpreted to become like the most political artwork today, according to its interpretation. So it's not just about the intention of the artist, but about how that work is interpreted and interpolated into the world of politics today that would give it agency. And so the artist and the artwork becomes kind of removed from the political in some way. But at the same time, the question of, well, what is a committed artist? We know, and of course, Theodore Adorno wrote a lot about this. He wrote that text on commitment, asks us to really think about what intentionality is, like what accountability, what responsibility, and what intentionality is for an artist, even though we might know that with all the best intentions, our artworks might not even be seen by anyone. And even if they are seen, we cannot know what will be interpreted from them in a kind of absolute sense, right? We can only hope or have some faith that what we're kind of, that the motivations of what we're, or the things that mobilize us to make the work might somehow come across somehow through this representational space. So in a way, you know, artists are electing to work in a very complex space of representations that often can be seen to ambiguate or obfuscate some kind of idea of a direct message or something like that. And even when artists put forward in their work very direct messages, like dogmatic propaganda, and when they say, do this, do that, this is how the world should be, which I have done in my work, the artwork, because it's a representation, always already seems to have this theatrical distance from the world of direct, what we might conceive of as more unmediated experiences. So I think, you know, to answer your question really about accountability, responsibility, and commitment, I think that even though I've just said that all of these things are very complex and we're often, you know, imbricated within disappointments about the kind of cause and effect relationships of art and politics, what that kind of space does is it allows certain freedoms to experiment and to test out what commitment can look like and be. And often when we've seen what commitment looks like and is in the history of art and history of politics, we found that it fails, that forms of protest have failed us, forms of understanding how we structure our political conversations have failed us. Representations haven't been adequate for us to understand the complexity of our reality today. So I think that the representational space that art offers gives us this amazing opportunity to explore new forms of language that are accountable by the very fact that they're looking for languages to explain and explicate and understand the complexity that we find ourselves in today. And yet they cannot promise us anything in particular. They cannot promise or guarantee a future that will result from this. And I think for me, that's the strongest commitment that we can see in art. Not a commitment to saying, I promise that this will lead to X and X, but a commitment to a rigorous kind of practice that has its own exploration into the possibilities of what can be said and what can be done in the political that might not exist at all, and it might never exist. And the risk, for want of a better word, the risk that art takes is that when that artwork lands in the public, it'll never be understood either.
Thank you. You said something during that conversation about what is a committed artist, and it kind of prompted me to think, as a viewer, as a, not an artist, what is a committed viewer? And will what mobilize you to create the work maybe mobilize a viewer or inspire someone to then continue to create something else? And I think that in interpretation that can become action and reality is something that's very interesting within the art world, because you don't really see a lot of that in other places. Mostly in art, you get one thing and it continues to expand for long periods of time, different styles, different interpretations. And I find that so interesting and so great, because there's so much information and so much history within different mediums. But I would love to pass it to Megana to ask about her takeaways that your viewers might have.
Yeah, so you definitely touched on this a little bit in the question, but I wanted to see if we could elaborate a little bit, because you make a lot of artwork on like very like heavy topics. And so you probably, I mean, I am interested to see like if you have a certain, well, you have a certain message that you're trying to convey, but like if it ever kind of becomes something that you don't expect. So I guess my question is there any specific takeaway that you hope your audiences have when viewing your art? Is it the same across the board? Like, are you provoking questions? Is it a call to action? Like, and then have you put something out that received very different feedback than you expected, or any different interpretations that you were surprised by?
Oh, okay. So first of all, I think that what you both have just articulated is something that I want to give me an opportunity to clarify something, which is this. So one of the problems I think we face in the history of art and the history of artistic critique is how we've come to expect art to produce the experience of confounding us, right? So we go to an art gallery and we expect to be confounded in some way, to approach the limits of our capacity of knowing, and then asked to rethink things that we thought we believed in a different way. And I think that whilst, you know, we can say that's a really good role for arts in its kind of skepticism of what we take as the given, you know, it's just natural to us, and yet we find it's actually a product of our constructed or engineered lives in the world. What artwork runs into is the problem that its very critique becomes really naturalized and normalized, and the difference that artworks produce isn't this kind of radical difference that really brings us to rethink the conditions of our existence, but it becomes like the difference that's like novelty or titillation. And therefore, it means that the very home of critique for art, or its modality of critique, becomes a habit and a convention that is simply producing more and more commodities. So critique itself, the action of critique, whatever form it takes, whether it's in a painting, in a print, or in a performance, becomes a very conventional ideological condition that is actually feeding the structures of more commodities and more capital, rather than doing the thing that it thinks it's doing, which is producing the possibility for real difference, for real engagement with other possibilities and ways of being and thinking in the world. So in that respect, if an artwork attempts to bring an audience to become part of this labor, then it's important that the viewer is also working probably just as much as the artwork is working. That everyone's working, right? What kind of work are they doing? Well, it's experiential labor, it's cognitive labor. It's not I've gone to see an art show to make myself feel better about all the bad things in my life, right? Some artwork does that, and that's not the kind of artwork I'm interested in, although that work has its place, but I wouldn't want to call it art. So that's a form of cultural kind of therapy, which, as I say, can be really useful for some people, but I have more expectations for art in the kind of vein of a Marxist revolutionary politics. This is what I'm really interested in. So how can art engage what kinds of thinking has been deemed as alien or aleatory or beyond the capacities of even our thought and our imagination? And how can art bring these kind of thoughts to the material reality? Well, yeah, that requires a viewer who's willing to not just want to be shocked or titillated by something different, but to engage and work through difference and to understand, well, what is the difference that I'm seeing here? Some artists and some viewers don't want to do that labor. That's their choice. But I'm really interested in viewers who not only want to, but do it. The kind of viewer that does that is not necessarily this well-read, intellectualized creature who's read philosophy and seen many artworks before, but it's someone who's just open and curious to the possibilities of an imagination beyond what they could have imagined previously. And for me, it's therefore a kind of partnership in labor and work, rather than something that is reliant upon a whole set of forms of baseline intelligence, or you must have read this or seen this movie or had these experiences in order to participate in this. So, I mean, I've known people in audiences who are like people who've never been to an art gallery before and say to me, well, I don't know about the art world and all of the fancy things I'm supposed to say about this, but it does remind me of all of these problems that I know about, say, detective fiction, where no one can actually form a community and it's really difficult. So what languages does it take to form a community? And those responses make me go, well, wow, that's exactly what I want to talk about. So this is amazing. And you've never seen an artwork before, and that doesn't matter because you understood that. And that's great. That's more than I could have expected from most people looking at the work. And so in that sense, many of the responses to my work have not been surprising to me. I've not really encountered anyone with a completely different view of what I think the work is doing. But what is exciting is that when people bring nuances to that description of the work, and therefore allow me to, as I was saying with the idea of practice, like to go down another rabbit hole and go, okay, what if I interpreted my view of the alien or the radical imaginary through this person's way of describing it, that's very different to my own, but has in common the same interests and themes.
Well, thank you so much. That was a great response to that question. Unfortunately, I cannot believe this, but we've kind of run out of time, and it's time for the audience Q&A. I believe we can fit in one more question, or should we move to the Q&A? One more question. Yes, I've got one more question. Okay, so I'd love to pass it to Anya to ask our last question before we begin the audience Q&A, and I would just love to remind everyone to add your questions for Ms. Amanda Beach in case you would like to have them answered. So to Anya.
Yeah, thank you again for that really wonderful answer. I guess my last question then kind of returns from the reception to the process itself, but still to the process of production, but is also related to your answer, I think, in some way, which is about how, like, given that you know that your audience doesn't necessarily need to be well-versed in the kinds of philosophical or theoretical canons that you're working with in order to understand where you're coming from or what your intended message is, like, what is the function of these kind of philosophical concepts in your process as you're creating art? Like, what is the relationship between that and especially the kind of contemporary politics that you're working with? Especially given that you're working with, like, you've mentioned a few canonical philosophers throughout our conversation today. So it's kind of a multiple question, but I'm wondering how you think about the relationship between these kinds of philosophical canons, the contemporary politics you're talking about, and then maybe on the other end of it, how people who may or may not be well-versed in those canons will receive your commentary on politics or your intervention.
Well, yeah, I think that the the kind of philosophical questions that I'm interested in are imbricated and part of political issues. In fact, the question of what politics is and the question of the future. So the philosophical question that drives a lot of my practice is, what is the relation and non-relation between what is and what ought to be? Right. So I can say that if I talk about what is, I could say, well, what is the is of what I'm talking about? So some people in that respect think that when we talk about realism, we're talking about a form of social realism, which is a depiction of the world of appearances. So like a soap opera might be a form of social realism where it depicts the everyday lives of people. But when I talk about realism, I'm referring to a philosophical problem of talking about a reality that we cannot know, we cannot have access to, we cannot even imagine. So what is it to talk about the space of negativity, the space of what is beyond our grasp? And we can say that that has some kind of analogy with the question of a future. There's some things we can say about our future that we know will happen, such as the end of the world in the future, the explosion of the sun. We know that that will happen. We know science tells us this. But the very question of the political scale of the future, which is common to our mortality, but also our children and our children's children, the kind of human scale of the questions of the future, become show us that we do have a role in forming and producing that future, that every time we describe what is, it has some traction on landing as a description in the world. And that description in the world forms our lived reality and therefore has some predictive and probabilistic consequences for tomorrow and the next day. Not all of these descriptions will take hold, right? Some of them will just float away or never be seen or never understood. But I'm interested in the possibility that some of these more complex and difficult descriptions of what reality is will have traction against the reality that we live in, when the reality we live in is an amalgamation of fictions that we tell ourselves about what reality is, then we can think about how science fictions, let's call them, right, scientific fictions that are made by art, can purchase and have traction that kind of produces a tension between or a withering away of some of the old ideas of what reality is, and that and replaces them with more accurate and rigorous articulations of what it is. So for me, I don't know if this is making sense, but these are all philosophical questions, right? They sound really metaphysical, like what is this, you know? And they also seem metaphysical and philosophical because the answer is, when you come to first philosophy, well, we'll never know for sure. But we keep asking them. And the political, to be enlivened for a future and to think about progress, if we dare even mention that word, progress towards equity, and a framework where we are all able to work and thrive and have basic needs met, such as food, education, and quality of life for all. These are really hard and fast material questions about our lived reality that need to be urgently addressed now. And I believe that these philosophical questions that seem on one hand to be so distanced and so esoteric and like often kind of ambiguous, actually are required by the political. Like, the political can't work without asking these big fat questions about who we are and how we see ourselves and how we can see ourselves not just as guilty humans or heroes of the hour, but as parts of a structure of reality that is much bigger than us. So these philosophical questions allow us to see ourselves in some way as subjectless or alienated, but this alienation can be really constructive and allow us to see ourselves rather than as eyes in the world, like individuals. It can allow us to see ourselves as a we, as sharing a more common ground. And the common, or perhaps better put, the necessity to formulate what is a common space in order to have a future at all. And we can't have a future, I believe, without the inauguration of a we, a plurality and a commonality. And the only way to do that, I think, is by working across philosophical questions and the very question of that imbrication within lived reality. And I think art is one space where that happens, and it can happen really well. But on the other hand, as I said, it can fail tragically, where artworks just become this apology for liberal politics.
Yeah, it's such a great answer, but I think that your emphasis throughout on the urgency and on the very like material urgency of things and the way that philosophy is often thought of as separate from them, but we kind of see consistently that it is never really apart from or prior to. I appreciate that part of your answer as well as the rest of it.
Thanks.
Well, thank you again. As I said before, unfortunately, we've run out of time, but this was a great discussion. I enjoyed the whole thing, and I would love to pass it to Anya for the Q&A to end.
Yes, back to me. We do have a question from an audience member, which I think is a really interesting one that kind of differs from the conversation we've been having so far about teaching. So the question is, does teaching mean something different to you politically than creating as an artist or a writer? And do you feel accountable in what you're instilling in students differently from how you might feel accountable as an artist or public intellectual?
This is a really, really great question, because it asks us about what we conceive as openness in the space of pedagogy and the capacity for students to grow and formulate their own positions in the world, which can be extremely different to mine. One thing that I do when I am teaching is I never teach my own work. I never teach my own texts. And if students want to find out about what I personally think, they can go off and find out about that and talk to me privately. But I'm not really interested in, delivering my knotty, dense, and sometimes nuanced arguments to students. Instead, what I'm interested in opening up, and this is where the research and the pedagogy do kind of really coagulate and you can't pull them apart, is that when I am teaching, I am really interested in asking people to think about the relationship between philosophy and the political, as I've just been saying, and to also engage with questions of how art has played a role in producing our reality as we know it, whether this is in the form of art that critiques and tries to resist the reality that we live in, or if it's part of a statist propagandist art that explicitly adheres to forms of power. So that's where I guess it's in the kind of subject matter where I enjoy teaching across these two elements, but in the actual political positions that arise from that, I'm interested to see what students make of these problems themselves. And that's what's the great thing about teaching, is because I'll never know what they're going to say to me, and I'll never know what they're going to think. And in fact, of course, as I'm sure we all know, that when you're in a seminar group and we're all reading Sylvia Winter or Frantz Fanon or Althusser or Hegel, there's going to be quite a heated debate about the not only the beliefs and critiques that are put forward in any of these people's work, but also people's attitudes to the consequences of their thought, like whether they see them simply describing the status quo and kind of feeling lost within that description and saying, well, all we can do is describe the problem, and that description of the problem cannot move past it. Or we need to describe the problem, and the very description of the problem is a mode of moving past it in itself, because we have the capacity to know it or be conscious of it in some way. And these positions, again, are really complex and nuanced, but you see these different things arise in the classroom. And I am fascinated by people's different positions on, you know, we might have a nihilist in the classroom, we might have a materialist, we might have both, we might have an idealist, we might have a theologian. And all of these positions deliver different problems for us to talk about as a group.
Yeah, thank you. I wish that we had more time so that we could talk more about all of your answers, but they're also wonderful. But I want to get to one last question, which is, again, kind of a departure from most of the conversation we've been having, which is about geography and art. So you have lived and worked between LA and London and elsewhere, and the power structures and political dynamics in, say, London and LA are very different. And so this question is, did those differences affect your artwork? And do you find that your art and your message change with your geography?
Oh, it's a really interesting question, because it's fascinating to me, because before I moved to Los Angeles, I was coming here to make artwork. So I came to make a piece called Sanity Assassin in 2009 and was supported by the Villa Aurora, who I work with, and also the Getty Museum. And after that, or even before that, actually, I was coming to Las Vegas to make work, and I was making a whole series of works around mythologies of the desert, which I'm still very much interested in. And so it was always a place that attracted me. And as someone who'd written a lot through Foucault's work in the past and discourses on power, and knowing Foucault's, you know, complex relationship to Los Angeles as well, this particular state and others were really wonderful sites for me to kind of explore the problems of America in itself, that I always saw was offering a more, let's say, explicit, pragmatic, and transparent view of its own problems of totalitarian liberalism than most other places at the time. Britain, of course, is also has suffered and continues to suffer and enjoys the symptom of its totalitarian liberalism too much. And so, of course, I could have used sites that are geographically located in the UK to talk about these issues as well. And I have done in the past with works like Statecraft, which was shot in a housing estate in Harlow, Newtown, which was a place north of London. So for me, the shift to moving here, which has now been 11 years, which is quite incredible, it's not as such created, it's not the geography necessarily that's created a shift in my thinking. But what has, what will always, I think, create a shift in people's thought is the political climate and the increased desperation that we see around issues of inequality through capitalism, the way that that legacy of colonialism still impacts us all, and the way that we can think about the problems of sex, gender and race. Is it possible to think about their imbrication or their entanglement with problems of economics and class structures that Marxism kind of privileges more than the others? So for me, what's become more urgent is to think about the tensions and the alliances between these different formats of political consciousness raising, and also the politics of what is a kind of method that we can share that deals with all of these problems when often a method can be only useful for kind of one disciplinary way of thinking. So I guess what it's led me to think about this change in our times, I guess, over the past decade, is to think about a cohesive multidisciplinary way of working that operates across literally across disciplines, that is in partnership with architects, geographers, scientists, mathematicians, poets, fiction writers, artists, philosophers, and how we together can produce forms of cohesion that are more expressing a kind of solidarity that we need today. So I think that's always something I've been interested in, actually. But I think that over the past decade, it's become, like we said, much more urgent to produce these groups that are global, that are not geographically located, but where across these disciplines, we all share these same problems. And we need to talk about how we're all dealing with it in our own domestic, like, academic disciplines, but also in the world.
Thank you. Again, I wish we could talk more about this, but I think that's actually a very good place for us to end here, leave the viewers and listeners with a little to think about how where our current world is. On that note, I want to thank our viewers for their questions and for tuning in, as well as you, Amanda, for speaking with us today and for having all of your wonderful answers to our questions. Our next program in this series will be with Sasha Razor, who is a lecturer in Germanic and Slavic Studies and Film and Media Studies at UC Santa Barbara on September 27th. So on that note, again, thank you everyone so much, and hopefully we will see you next time for our next program.
Thank you.